This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We're human guinea pigs. They've sacrificed this community for nuclear production.
A whistleblower reports on the massive cancer cover-up at an Ohio nuclear facility and her decades-long fight for justice.
We were able to reveal that there were over 280 military cargo shipments that left the Oakland airport for the Nevatim Air Base just since January of 2025.
Activists call for a labor boycott of Israel as thousands of Palestine supporters gather in Detroit at the People's Conference for Palestine.
It takes solidarity. It takes a clear vision and commitment to public education, free for all. We will have to steel ourselves because this has been and will continue to be an unrelenting fight for the promise of public education.
The new head of the Washington Teachers Union speaks out against attacks on public education at the Free DC rally.
Freedom for all, justice for all. I don't believe that. You know, I don't feel like that's happening for black people. And so I don't feel like I can say pledge allegiance to a flag that is not supporting me and supporting my people.
We honor the life of Nkengi Touré, trailblazing civil rights activist, black feminist, and advocate for black women's health initiatives. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. This past month, there was a national conference in Portsmouth in southern Ohio. Residents and workers there reported on the massive cancer epidemic and cover-up at the Piketon Nuclear Processing Facility, where, according to the participants, tens of thousands of people have been contaminated and gotten cancer. Vina Colley is a retired electrician, a former member of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and an activist with the Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security. She spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
This is Pacifica with Steve Zeltzer, and I'm here with Vina Colley. She organized a conference here in Portsmouth around the issue of the cancer epidemic, who's responsible, and a large number of people came from the community here talking about their contamination, their fight for health care, their fight for justice, and the long struggle that they've had here. Vina, so this conference that was held this weekend brought together a lot of people who've been affected, and it seems like there is a cancer epidemic in this area as a result of the industry, nuclear industry here.
It's very obvious that there's a big, huge problem here, and they don't want to address it because we're important to the government, because they want to continue to do production here at the site.
And the situation of these workers and community, their families, they have cancer, they're fighting to get health care. A number of them said they're on Medicaid. They can't even get the tests that they need. Has the health department or any federal agencies done any surveys of the people in this area?
I don't know about the local one here in Portsmouth, but in Piketon, Matt Brewster, he was taking a collection up of the cancer victims, and I took him in 230-some names, that almost 300 names, that we went door-to-door and showed that the people had cancer. And that was a long time ago when we did that.
When did you start this struggle?
I started in 1983 when I filed my first grievance about the plant, and I thought there were more than 30 workers being exposed to radiation. I didn't know how, but I just felt like they were because I heard workers talking about it. But we were working in, we were cleaning down electric equipment with trichloroethylene, and it had polychlorinated biphenylene's PCB oil on them. Well, what we didn't know at this time, and I didn't find out until almost in the 90s, that PCB oil was radioactive oil. And we weren't dressed. We didn't have gloves, we didn't have masks on, we didn't have paper coveralls, we had nothing but hard hats and safety glasses. And that's one reason I thought the plant was so safe, because I never worked anywhere where they stressed that you wear this hard hat and your safety glasses. So, and then they had yellow tape around certain areas at the plant, and I said, what are those? And they said, we're not supposed to go in that area, it's contaminated. Like, that yellow tape kept that contamination there. And of course, I was young and stupid when I went to work there. I didn't even know it was a weapons production plant. I thought it was Goodyear tar and rubber.
So this was oil, chemical, and atomic workers.
Yes, it was oil, chemical.
And you were active in the union as protecting health and safety?
Yes. And what I didn't know, I went to work in 1980. And by 1979 and 80, this union was in Washington, D.C. It was one of the largest movements in the union. Up there talking about the radiation, they had 570-some violations. And so they went to they stormed Senator Glenn's office, and then Bob Alvarez, he was there, and he took all their documents. But the sad part about when they came back to Portsmouth, nothing. They went after the president of the union, who was Denny Bloomfield, and nothing's been done. I mean, no matter, and even 1957, as far back as 1957, with my research, I found out that workers were dying of leukemia, and the government finally paid some of them. And so far back as 1957, and here we are, what, 2025, workers are still dying, the community's dying, and nothing. They don't want to admit that we have plutonium here. We had plutonium that was shipped straight into Piketon. It was not diluted. It was straight plutonium. And then we had a X705 building where they used plutonium, and all these workers were so contaminated that they had to ship them down to Oak Ridge to decontaminate them. They made, I don't know how many trips, but I do have the workers' names, and I have the workers' exposures that they had. And so by 1985, my boss had to keep an eye on me because I was getting sick, and I break out in rashes, and I took a year off of work, still not really thinking it was my job. And by 1985, my boss had to keep an eye on me, and I was in this roundhouse 300 building at the plant. And we were down there pulling cables in the cable tray, and I saw this oily, tacky stuff. And the guy that I worked with, his name was Howard Lyons, and he had had a heart attack. And I told Howard, I'll climb up in the cable trays for you. And there was a mist in the cable trays and this oily stuff. And I said, where's this oil coming from? And he said, oh, probably where they done maintenance work and people, the workers dropped the oil in the cables and that. And so I started breaking out in rashes. And then I called health physics, which I didn't know, it goes straight into the supervisors. And health physicists came over and told me that I was better than their machines that picks this up. And so they pulled me off that job because it was radioactive, but they didn't want to say. So my boss put me on this electrical equipment that was outside so I'd be away from everybody. And then I happened to be, it was like a ceramic electrical stuff was taken off of this component. And I kept looking around, and I see all these little gray particles everywhere. So I get scared, and I put a bandana around my mouth. And I hurried up and got that job over. So my boss came over and got me on the golf cart, took me off that job. And then he said he got a call. We're going to go over here in the 333 building. And this is the building they're getting ready to decommission. So we went over there. He had a golf cart. So we go up on the top floor. We get off the elevator, and we get halfway down the aisle. And all of a sudden, this big stuff, gray stuff, come chasing after us. He turns around and gets on the elevator. And I said, what just happened? And he said, nothing. It's not our job no more, because we was over there on a radiation alarm. And he said, it's not our job anymore. And so the next day, through the night, I got really, really sick, and I had to go over to a nose, ear, and throat doctor, and he took a biopsy of my throat, and he said that I looked like another worker that came in there, and he found small gray particles in my lungs. And so he said, I look like another worker. And he said, I'm going to send you down to Cincinnati to an occupational health and safety doctor. So I go down there, and the doctor, he did all kind of urine tests and all this, and he found 2.12 industrial fluorides in my urinalysis about a week or two after I left the plant. So we have uranium hexafluorides here, and they release a lot of fluorides. And in my opinion, they cover up the plutonium. And I think one way that it got released from the plant, it mixed in with these fluorides. So we have plutonium fluorides, and we have plutonium, and we have neptunium and americia. And this stuff is depending on the wind, and it's just not going in one direction. It's going around the plant in all different directions. And I would figure maybe air miles, maybe 50 miles sometimes, depending on how the storm and the winds were going. And so I've been working with Dr. Ketter, and we've been taking samples, and we know that 15 miles from that plant is contaminated for sure, because that's how far we have tested out. The company did an in vivo on me because women were new at the plant in the late 70s. So they did an in vivo, and it's sort of like a tanning bed. They put you in this machine, and it picks up, it picked up neptunium, and it picked up Tech-99, and it picked up cesium in my lungs. And it picked up all the uranium, but they
so
never.
You were being contaminated.
Oh yeah, from day one. When I went to work out there, we were being contaminated, and they never told us. And like we said, we thought it was a safe job because hard hats and safety glasses. So then I started researching, getting documents, talking to workers, and I will show you my documents. And so I found out that we had plutonium at the plant. And in 93, I addressed it with, they had a big meeting, and the media picked up on it. In 93, we had plutonium, and it was a deposition. So they knew because I told them so. The public knew, but they denied they had plutonium. And then in 1999, there was a congressional hearing for these workers, and they put Oak Ridge and Paducah in the compensation bill. And I got a hold of Ted Strickland, and I said, why aren't we in this? And Marvin Resnikoff and Mary Bird Davis came here, and they went through my records, and we found the plutonium and stuff too. And Marvin did a groundwater report. 360 acres out there was contaminated with plutonium.
And so this material is really being spread all around.
It's going everywhere.
It's going everywhere in the community. People, residents, families are all getting contaminated.
It's going all the way to Mississippi. They have a pipe that comes straight from the plant, straight to the Scioto River. The Scioto River goes to the 20 miles to the Ohio River, and the Ohio River flows to the Mississippi. Now we have one of the largest aquifers underneath in the Midwest underneath this plant. And there's two aquifers, a smaller one and a bigger one. If this aquifer, the biggest one, is leaking, it's going to go all the way to Indiana. So the aquifer will contaminate all those cities to Indiana, and their discharges from the plant and these creeks go all the way to Mississippi. So it's just not Piketon that's being affected. You know, there's a lot of people being affected by our plant.
And that's why they want to keep it quiet. They don't want these people to know.
Little beaver, I went to the EPA office sometime around 92, 93, and I found this paper right here from the EPA office that says Little Beaver Creek is contaminated. To this day, and this is where everybody's taking all these samples and they're finding neptunium and stuff, to this day they have not admitted that there's off-site contamination there. And they refuse to put signs up in the creeks. No fishing, because this creek's radioactive. And the other day I was out there, and a guy was out there fishing with his dog. They don't care. And there's a trailer park real close to where this creek is, and these little kids, that trailer park was put on the hot list, and they have three wells on this site, and they made them switch wells. But it's a low-income trailer park, and they don't care.
So they don't really care about these people who are being contaminated.
We're human guinea pigs. They've sacrificed this community for nuclear production.
And this area is also home to Vance. He was the senator, J.D. Vance.
J.D. Vance.
And does he know about what's going on here?
Well, he should, because we petitioned Senator Brown's office to get us into RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. He goes over to the Senate, and Lujan from New Mexico, and Brown grabbed Vance by the neck and said, let's go to this hearing. So Vance knows about this area, but I haven't been able to get a hold of him yet. I don't have the right email. But him and Senator Brown went over to that Senate hearing, and Lujan, I have a video of it, saying, I hear you, I hear you. We are going to get Scioto and Piketon in this. Well, Brown didn't get reelected. and neither did Tim Ryan. And so now we have to start all over. But one good thing about when we petition, Brown calls down here to the area city councils, the governor councils, the commissioners, and we got all these letters that they want to put us into RICA. Now, why would any of these people want to put us into RICA if we don't have a problem? They know we have a problem. They want to keep producing. So put these people in RICA. They put in RICA people that aren't important anymore because they're not in production, and a landfill. And here we are, the largest facility in the world. We have 24,000 depleted uranium cylinders sitting outside that give off neutron exposures, and they want to keep us producing. They don't want to put these people in RICA.
And the situation in East Palestine, there was Chris Albright who came. Again, the Vance and Brown both said that they wanted to support these people getting health care, support the Stafford Act. Vance gets elected, becomes vice president, and they can't do anything, it seems, to protect the health. I mean, it seems like these people in these communities who are desperate in need of health care, they can't even get the health care that they need.
Well, this is the most contaminated facility in the world. And when I heard about East Palestine, here, this is public. I mean, it's knowledge, public knowledge. It's all over the media, and they can't deny it. And when I went out there, these people are sick. Chris is sick. His story is devastating, and it just broke my heart. Because like Python, it's a secret, and you're not supposed to talk about it. But East Palestine, here comes, I think Trump came there too, didn't he? And I think I've seen Aaron Brockovich there, and nothing. They walked off, and they've left him. If I remember right, J.D. Vance came in, and he said, you know, a year or so ago, I was here, and you all really did need health care. But they've cleaned it up. And it's not cleaned up, and they're never going to clean it up.
Well, this idea that radioactive sites, I know in San Francisco, Hunters Point Shipyard, Treasure Island, they're building condos on a radioactive nuclear dump.
Yeah.
I mean, so it has nice views, but you're being contaminated. I mean, the people there are sick with cancers and other things. It seems it's an epidemic of cancers in this country. Is this part of the reason there's an epidemic of cancers?
Well, we have the highest rate of cancer in the state of Ohio, and we also 107 in childhood, nationally above the average nationally here in Piketon with leukemia with kids.
And what about the governor, DeWine? Has he said he was going to take care of it? And does he know about this?
Well, you know, DeWine and all of them was involved with the workers getting compensation. The workers are under the Energy Employees Compensation Act, the EEOICPA. And they're paying these workers for 22 cancers. 22 cancers. If you work at this plant, and it don't matter whether you smoke or not, they're paying for their cancers, and they're paying for illnesses. I have chronic bronchitis. I have Brilliant disease, and Brilliant disease, there's no cure. It just eats your lungs away. And I have neuropathy, and I have a nerve condition from the neuropathy that's affecting my motor skills. I have congestive heart failure. I have digital heart failure, and I have so many things. And they're paying for these. They admitted that they caused this problem because when I went to work there, I was a healthy worker. I was so healthy, they sent me back to my doctor to run more tests on me. I mean, they couldn't believe how healthy I was. And I think because I had these healthy genes, that I'm still alive to fight them.
That was Vina Colley, retired electrician, former member of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and activist with the Portsmouth-Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security. She spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Michael Jackson, They Don't Care About Us. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. This past weekend, thousands of supporters of Palestine gathered in Detroit at the People's Conference for Palestine. Palestine Youth Movement leader Aisha Nizar talked about the discovery of massive traffic of military parts from the Port of Oakland by air to Israel and the plan to stop it at other airports around the country. Also in this story, Moroccan-Palestinian activist Ismail Al-Ghazawi was jailed after supporting mobilizations to stop the genocide. He reports on the effort to build a movement of dockers in Morocco to stop shipping military parts to Israel.
Citywide arms embargo campaign to actually stop the flow of weapons leaving the city of Oakland. And this started with research. We were able to reveal that there were over 280 military cargo shipments that left the Oakland airport for the Nevatim Air Base just since January of 2025. This is a city that was one of the first cities that called for a ceasefire. This is a city that has the only ILWU Local 10, the only longshore union that has enacted an arms embargo in the United States. They are based in Oakland. So Oakland stands for progressive values. Oakland stands with Palestine. There ain't no question about that. The fact that we were able to document this and to expose this actually produces an opportunity for us to heighten the contradictions and set a precedent for the rest of the country to follow. We're inviting you to get plugged into this campaign. You can see our research report that details also over 29 cities that are a part of this supply chain that are sending weapons to the Zionist entity. So y'all are questioning, oh, is my city complicit in this? Well, we probably have it for you. Go home and put it to your city council, to your port authority, and say, we know this is happening in our locale, and we know that our people do not stand for it. Especially y'all who have cities that voted in a ceasefire, that voted in a resolution for a ceasefire, you have an opportunity to advance that ideological commitment to something that's material. And like Sachin was saying, we need action right now. We need action for our people back home.
Ismail, in your native Morocco especially, we've seen an incredible surge of popular mobilizations in response to the military cargo destined to Israel being docked in Moroccan ports. And in fact, Ismail, in December 2024, you were imprisoned for the role you played in the mass demonstrations against Maersk ships carrying military cargo to Israel.
The context in Morocco is that although we are living in a country that is connected to Palestine through history ties, through blood ties, through a lot of, how can I say, struggles together, we have been facing the normalizing accords since 2020, and since then we have been struggling ever since with the Zionist entity getting, getting into our businesses, getting into our politics, getting into our economy, and lately we have been actually complicit with delivering weapons and delivering military equipment to the Zionist entity. Stopped the ships. Now it's coming to us, going through the Moroccan ports. And honestly, Sachin said that the American feel that they are living in an evil country. In Morocco, we are saying now that we are living in a country knee deep in double standards. Because at the same time, when the Muslim and Arab summit was taking place, and Moroccan representative was saying that we are doing our best to have peace in Palestine and to help our the people over there. At the same time, the exact same day, a ship was going out of the Moroccan, the Tangier port, delivering military equipment to the Zionist entity. And it feels so wrong that we are so now attracted to making money. And in this imperialist, how can I say, regime, or imperialist oppression, that we don't get moral values anymore. Although we are breaking now, the Moroccan government doing this is breaking several regulations and is contradicting its own resolutions, being a UN member, and also signing a UN letter calling for an arms embargo on Israel back in November 2024. It really is a shame. And we have a say as people. people don't want to be involved in war crimes. We don't want to be involved or complicit on a genocide in our brethren in Gaza. So we said no, and we took it to the streets. And this is with the help with grassroots movement. I myself, I'm involved and active member of the BDS movement in Morocco. And with the help of PYM, we are connected with getting the information and then doing something with it. And that something is calling upon member of associations and lawyers and the politicians to put the pressure and make it known that now the government is involved or complicit in genocide by doing so, and calling on dock workers, Moroccan dock workers, to have a say in that, because we are calling them as the front line or the first line of defense, because they can't do something. The country is its own people. The people have a say in this, and the arms embargo is a really strong weapon, and we have a say, we have a will. And honestly, we were so proud when we noticed that the shipments were delayed. Sometimes it was by 40 hours, sometimes 12 hours. And later on, we heard that a lot of dock workers boycotted or said, we won't work these ships, because they saw things with their own eyes. They saw military equipment that they see on the TV arresting innocent people or killing and murdering innocent people. And it didn't stand right with them. And so I believe on the ground we are doing what we can, but we are still short on especially the political kind of approach. I believe we need to approach more politicians, more decision makers, so that they can stand for what's right. If not now, then when? And so in order to give numbers, when we say that Morocco have been delivering military equipment, it's not stopping there. We are now going from normalizing as a treason to the Palestinian people. Now it's becoming a crime, because we saw that after the normalization, things accelerated, and we have you have articles depicting that Morocco now, or the Moroccan government, is going to get weapons and arms and equipment from the Zionist entity, procured two sites for $1 billion. It procured artillery equipment for $200 million. And I believe it installed, or it's going to install, drone factories for the Elbit systems, which is, and Bluebird, so two Israeli companies. I believe that it's not completely gloomy, but with the help of the people, with the help of grassroots movements, and with the help of abroad associations and abroad movements, we can grow stronger. And honestly, we felt so, how can I say, it was heartwarming seeing other members of other grassroots movements saluting Moroccan dock workers. And I myself, I salute other dock workers in the Mediterranean area, Greece and Italy and Turkey and other, I believe I'm forgetting others, because it has been growing so well. This campaign is new here in Morocco. I think we started in November last year. It's coming to around a year, but still the information is key. In the public, they are always asking questions about how sure are you of this information. And we say simply that how can the Spanish government be so adamant in their decision if they don't have proof? It's the same system or the same method has just been moved from Spain to Morocco. We're talking about the ships almost and the same cargo. So when we get good info, we expose it the sooner the better. And then the reaction by the unions and the grassroots movements and other people, it makes the pressure so hard on the authorities. And we are just asking, our simple demand is inspect. Because once you inspect and you tell us the content, it will be a clear violation of regulation, clear violation of resolutions, and that would push them to take the appropriate measure, to take the appropriate action. And so far, we have been met with deafening silence. from the authorities, like nothing. So to just be completely clear, what worked is that we created more links between movements, associations, and now we are getting to we are at the stage to approach dock workers more and to tell them that you have a good, how can I say, safety net. We have lawyers, we have associations of human rights that can actually protect once you make that decision, because it's not a simple decision to make. You are risking your own livelihood by putting your work at risk. And by doing so, we are trying to tell them you're doing the right thing, and they don't have any right to pressure you to work against moral values, to work against actually regulations, because Maersk are being so sneaky, trying, like Aisha explained, they're not shipping weapons, they're shipping military parts or parts of or whatever. At the same time, in their own charter, they are saying that they abide by the UN human rights values in their code of conduct. And if you are asking an employee to load a military equipment that will be used for genocide, that is complete infringement of that code of conduct. So this is where we are at. So we have clearly came a long way. Before, we were just at the stage of telling people what's happening, but now we are at the stage of let's do something about it. And that something needs to be organized, needs to come at one time, come in strong, so that the pressure will be so hard that they cannot avoid it or say something else. So we are working now in this front and also in the legal front of things. So we are working to put the pressure on the port authorities to tell them that you need to inspect. You are forced by law to inspect, because this is something that is unlawful going on in the ports, and we need to do something about it.
That was a report from the People's Conference on Palestine on the struggle to stop military cargo from being transported to Israel. We heard from Aisha Nizar with the Palestinian Youth Movement and Ismail Al-Ghazawi, a Moroccan-Palestinian activist who is working to get dockers to stop sending the weapons to Israel for the genocide. Labor leader Chris Smalls also spoke at the conference and called out the AFL-CIO and other union leadership over their silence and complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
As a labor leader, it is our responsibility to be the shield for the working class. It is our responsibility to protect the working class. It is our responsibility to speak up when things are uncomfortable and take a stance. And our labor movement has failed us. They have failed us. Let's talk about it. 2 days ago, for the first time in labor history in America, the San Diego Labor Council, shout out to the people in San Diego, I know y'all in the crowd. The San Diego Labor Council passed a resolution declaring, finally, 2 years later, 500,000 innocent Palestinians dead, but they declared that it is a genocide. They are demanding accountability from the U.S. government and Israel, and they have done something that is dear to me. They echoed the words that I've been saying for months now, that the complicity and the participation of the AFL-CIO, one of the largest federations in America, that has 60 unions underneath their umbrella, and the longshoremen, who we may love and know their history very well, who stood on the right side of history against South Africa and their apartheid, they have failed us. Yes. Let me give you the context. Since October 7, they have passed zero resolutions. Zero. The San Diego Labor Council has put them on notice, saying that it's a shame that they have done this. Not only that, they took it a step further. The AFL-CIO is located in Washington, D.C., across the street from the White House. They sent a rep on a 6.5-hour flight to San Diego 2 days ago to try to kill that resolution. Shame, right? But guess what? Just like the people here today, the people in that room, they spoke up. Over 200 rank and file members and delegates kicked them the f*** out. So, and passed this resolution unanimously. So, power to the people, power to the workers, and that's what the power of people when we come together, it do. But there's still work to do. A lot more work to do. As y'all know, this is just the beginning, right? This is. And unfortunately, we're in a country where everything is always retroactive, right? We gotta wait for things to get bad and worse before it gets better. But we can't allow that anymore. We have to be proactive. We have to do more than what we've been doing. It's more than just doing rallies. It's more than just talking the talk. You gotta actually walk the walk. Everybody in this room, including myself, we lost something, right? Make some noise if you lost something speaking out against Palestine. Make some noise if you've been arguing with people over Palestine. Make some noise if you lost friends, family members, community. Well, guess what? That just means that you're doing the right thing. Trust me. Take it from somebody like me who gets a lot of hate. When people are hating on you for the things you're doing, it's because you're doing the right thing. And you cannot stop. You have to do more. So when, I'll give an example. October 7th, I was in Berlin, one of the largest communities for Palestine, outside of Palestine. 30 to 40,000 of them live in Berlin. I don't know why, but hey, to each your own, right? They're there. And I shared my experience. I saw how people were kettled in, dragged away from their children, how they can't say free Palestine, they can't raise a Palestinian flag. And I shared that experience when I came back to America that same week when the genocide started. And overnight, I lost over 10,000 followers on Instagram, Twitter, whatever. And you know what I had to say in response to that? F*** you. I don't care. And you know why? Same thing they told me against Amazon. Amazon's unorganizable. You guys are a circus. This is never going to happen. It's impossible. And that made me go even harder when I lost those followers. You know why? Because I knew speaking up about Palestine was the right thing to do. We're in some dark times, y'all. Dark times in humanity. So, as y'all know, I took this mission to go to Gaza, deliver humanitarian aid. But it's not about delivering humanitarian aid. It's about breaking their legal siege. And y'all know about the assault that happened to me. I was tackled to the ground, knee in my back, twisted the arms behind my back. They used my chains to choke me to the point where I couldn't breathe. They separated me. They put me in a room. They threw me up against the wall a few times, face first. They said some racist remarks. They said they're nothing like me. And they were talking about the skin color. And despite everything that I've been through, the whole time I was thinking about, this is just a fraction of what Palestinians are going through every day. A fraction. So as a New Yorker in me, I had to go to Israel and talk my shit. I didn't go all the way to Israel for nothing and to be silent. So I told the IOF to their face, they ain't shit. Oh, there's witnesses. You know, ironically, right? With the mad lean with Greta Thunberg and Diago and Yasmin, my comrades, it's ironic how they released all that propaganda, all the videos and pictures, sandwiches and water, all that bullshit. But with the Hundella mission, virtually nothing, right? Y'all ain't see any videos, pictures from Israel. Just a statement about me, the black man. The only black man on the crew, they said that I was the aggressor and the one who was provocative. Right, the same racist remarks that we hear all the time, the angry black man. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, I did talk my and I did give them the middle finger. I did. And I did say some other things, but I did it because Palestinians can't. And I did it because, once again,
thank you, Chris.
No, thank you. The Palestinian people, they say, you know, thank you for what I've done for your people. And it's like, no, thank you. Because Palestinians in Gaza has showed the world how to love and bring people together. Amina. So as an activist, I know I don't have that much time, but I want to say this. As an activist in me, I didn't come to Detroit just for a speech. I came here to deliver a message and tell y'all that we got to do more. And what we have to do is call out these individuals and entities that are continuing to participate, not complicit, but participate in this genocide. The AFL-CIO, they're located in Washington. Look out for me when I send out the signal call. When I throw up the bat signal, I need y'all to pull up to their headquarters in Washington, D.C. as a National Day of Action. When our governments fail us, it's up to the people to step up. When people ask me, how the hell did y'all beat a $2.2 trillion company like Amazon and took on Jeff Bezos, who was the richest man in the world, making $13 billion a day, $9 million an hour, $5,000 a second? You know the answer to that is? How did we defeat these people and the evilness of the world? The power of the people when we come together. So, this is a revolution. But the revolution starts with yourself.
That was former Amazon Labor Union President Chris Smalls speaking at the People's Conference for Palestine in Detroit.
على عهدي على ديني على أرضي تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني
على عهدي على ديني
على أرضي تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم والله أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني يلا زافي حلوة هلا هلا سمعونا زافي حلوة
That was Mohammed Asaf singing Dammi Falastini. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. At an August 28th rally called by the AFL-CIO DC Metropolitan Council, dubbed Free DC, Laura Fuchs, the newly elected president of the Washington Teachers Union, spoke about Trump's attacks on D.C. education workers and the history of attacks on public education in the District of Columbia.
Hello. The Washington Teachers Union is proud to represent close to 6,000 educators in this district. But we don't just represent teachers. We represent counselors, social workers, school psychologists, occupational therapists, and so many more who serve close to 50,000 students who are across 120 school sites here in the District of Columbia. We are very proud to do our job. Our job is to teach the truth. As a history and government teacher for the past 18 years, there is nothing more important than the ability that we have had to do what we have to do in our classrooms. We are proud to teach every single child, no matter where they come from or who they are. We will not back down to fascists who seek to tear our community apart. They want to destroy our schools. They want to stomp out our teachers' union. And we say absolutely not. In the face of a bunch of politicians who have chosen to turn aside from what is happening and shown indifference to what is going on outside of our classrooms, our educators have stepped up with community partners like Free DC and Defend DC Public Schools. And we have organized with parents, with the community, community-led safe passage routes over cops. Our educators have begun to set up networks inside their schools to make sure that they can communicate quickly and effectively with each other if and when necessary. They're having tough conversations about what we will have to do when the fascists come for our schools. But make no mistake, the billionaire attack on our public schools is not new. This started in the 1990s when the Republican Congress passed a Charter School Board Act that imposed charter schools on our district. That foothold has allowed billionaires to infiltrate our policymaking systems and education. Bezos, Bloomberg, Eli Broad, and for us, the worst one, the Waltons. They have been seeking to influence public education from the outset. They wanted vouchers, but they couldn't get them right away. And so instead, they started to infiltrate the public charter system. They then got mayoral control of our public schools here in D.C. Through that, they have now infiltrated D.C. public schools itself and have been seeking for the past 20 years to dismantle our schools from the inside. But we have been fighting this privatization the entire time. It has been union-led. It has been community-led. It has been parent-led. It has been student-led. And we can learn from all of those, both in the district and across the nation, who have been fighting against privatization of our schools for so long. It takes solidarity. It takes a clear vision and commitment to public education, free for all. We will have to steel ourselves because this has been and will continue to be an unrelenting fight for the promise of public education. But now is the time to stand up and fight back. We will fight for our public schools and the students we serve. We hope that you will fight alongside your teachers' unions. And we will fight for the very existence of a free public education for all. Public education that teaches the truth. A public education that prioritizes joy over testing. One that prioritizes our community over profit.
That was Washington Teachers Union President Laura Fuchs addressing the Free DC rally on August 28th. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I am Polina Vasiliev. Next, we mark the passing of Nkengi Ture, a leader in the reproductive justice, anti-racism, and black women's health movements, and former Black Panther. WPFW's Fahima Sek remembers her.
Nkengi Ture was born Anita Stroud on Monday, March 5, 1951, in Baltimore, Maryland. She moved to Washington, D.C. in 1971 to head up the Black Panther Party's Health and Education Project. She was a trailblazing civil rights activist, black feminist, and advocate for black women's health initiatives. Ture hosted the longtime radio show In Our Voices on Pacifica Radio WPFW in Washington, D.C. Nkengi Ture's archives are held at Smith College, including speeches, writings, and recordings in the Sophie Smith Collection. Ture is also featured in the National Women's History Museum. Homegoing services for Nkinji Touré are scheduled for Tuesday, September 2nd at J.B. Jenkins Funeral Home, 7474 Landover Road in Landover, Maryland. With viewing from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. and services from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. Repass to be announced. Echoes of Nkinji by Fahima Sek. From Baltimore's Bull Streets, in the blaze of 68 heats, Anita became Nkinji, dancing to the tune of her own drum beat. Black Panther, fierce, heeding New Africa's beckoning call, breaking oppressive chains and shattering American apartheid's wall. In our voices, lifting sisters, the truth we long for and crave. By amplifying Black women, their stories were aptly conveyed. Her voice lit the air on WPFW Pacifica's terrestrial wave. Tori's legacy burns a fire untamed. Her echo resounds in our voices reclaimed. From a panther's roar to the mic's fierce hum, Nkinji's echo endures forever and beyond. Rest in power, Queen. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Fahima Sek.
And we close with Nkinji Touré discussing her refusal to pledge allegiance to the American flag as a young student and the repercussions she faced for expressing her worldview.
The first thing that I did that I guess you would say was kind of an action was my own personal statement was that I refused to pledge the flag. And every morning in school, you know, in home period, you had to get up and say the Pledge of Allegiance and all that. And I refused to do it. And so they insisted that I do it, and I insisted that I wasn't going to do it. So they called my mother, and she came up, and she was none too pleased to have to take time off from work to come up there to the school. And they told her, well, your daughter is not pledging the flag. She's sitting in her seat and not standing up and not acknowledging. And my mother said, well, did you ask her why? Basically, that's what she said. Did you ask her why? And they were, well, why? Because freedom for all, justice for all. I don't believe that. You know, I don't feel like that's happening for Black people. And so I don't feel like I can say pledge allegiance to a flag that is not supporting me and supporting my people.
I don't know how my mother walked her trouble down. I don't know how my father stood in. Survived slavery. I do remember, that's why I believe. I don't know why the rivers overflow their veins. I don't know why the snow falls and covers the
Sweet Honey in the Rock, I Remember, I Believe. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke, Fahima Sek, Steve Zeltzer, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.